Exploration with Dr. Michio Kaku, Tuesdays at 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome. This is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is Exploration. Every week on Exploration, we discuss the fascinating world of science and its impact on society. Well, first of all, I'd like to wish everyone out there Happy New Year, and I hope that all of us can look forward to a prosperous and peaceful 2012. However, last week I made some predictions for 2012 and into the future, many of these predictions based on my book, Physics of the Future, which is a New York Times bestseller, and Amazon.com recently voted as one of the 100 best books of 2011. However, I made one prediction which has generated a certain amount of controversy. Last week I mentioned that 2012 will not see doomsday. In other words, don't quit your day job. Don't get divorced. You may live to see January 2013. And people begin to ask very specific questions about, well, what about this prophecy? Well, what about that prophecy? So before we begin with our special guest today, I'd like to, in detail, go through some of the so-called prophecies for December 21st of 2012. Afterwards, we're going to bring on our special guest today, who is a Nobel Prize winner, Professor Henry Pollack, author of a new book called World Without Ice. Now, at the present time, you may think that's silly, because outside, you just look out the window, and you see that most of the United States seems to be frozen solid. In fact, in New York City, temperatures can get all the way down to about 15 degrees above zero in Fahrenheit, and it seems ridiculous to talk about a world without ice. But that's precisely what Henry Pollack, Nobel laureate, is predicting for the future. The North Pole, for example, is already melting. Periodic visits to the North Pole by submarine for the last 50 years have shown a 50% drop in the thickness of the ice over the North Polar regions. And in parts of the summertime, the North Pole is completely free of ice today. And in the future, ships may be able to go right across the Northern Passage without having to detour around the Arctic ice. And already nations like Russia are jockeying for rights to the North Pole because they fully anticipate that the North Pole will be gone in the future. And our children will accuse us as perpetuating a fraud called Santa Claus, because in the future, even children will know that Santa Claus cannot exist on the North Pole because, well, there is no North Polar region of the planet Earth. But before we begin to discuss the new book, World Without Ice, let's talk about the prediction for 2012, the most controversial one being that the world is not going to end on December 21st, 2012. Well, first of all, as I mentioned, it all goes back to the Mayan prophecy. And according to the Mayan calendar, yes, indeed, one cycle ends in 2012, but then another cycle begins. You see, all indigenous peoples and native peoples have a calendar that's very close to Mother Nature. Mother Nature is cyclical in the seasons, and not surprisingly, all the calendars of native peoples are also cyclical. So when the Mayans said that the one cycle ends in 2012, it simply means that another cycle begins. However, certain Westerners, I think, hijacked this prophecy and said, aha, we can make a lot of money by saying it's actually Armageddon and Doomsday by imposing a Western philosophy on Native peoples. You see, Native peoples' mythology does not include an Armageddon or an apocalypse. That's something that comes from the West, from Christian ideology. And that's why we do not expect to see Mayan prophecies talking about the end of the world. And sure enough, there's not a single indication. There's not a single indication that the Mayan calendar predicts the end of the world. Nothing but the beginning of a new season. But let's take some of the prophecies one by one. First of all, if you saw the movie 2012, it starts ominously with an alignment of all the planets. This is sometimes called the Jupiter effect, when all the planets like Jupiter, Saturn are aligned, and this is supposed to rip the Earth apart. Well, first of all, the alignment of planets happens all the time, going all the way back into prehistory, going back billions of years, and hey, we're still here. Nothing much happens. In fact, the alignment of the planets is trivial compared to the gravitational field of the sun. And the sun does not rip us apart. So why should the alignment of planets, which does happen periodically, and the Earth has survived many an alignment of the planets. However, it makes for a great Hollywood movie, 2012. In fact, I had the privilege of interviewing the executive producer of that movie. And I asked them specifically, are you planning to do something in December 2012, like sell all your possessions and get drunk and indulge in wine, women, and song? And he said, quote, look, it's just a movie, unquote. So take it from the executive producer of the movie 2012, quote, it's just a movie. Well, the next prediction is that there's a 10th planet. A 10th planet out there that'll come close to the Earth, shift the Earth out of its orbit, creating cataclysmic changes in our weather and our pole and our orbit around the sun. Well, to be frank, there is no 10th planet. There are objects out there beyond the orbit of Pluto, but now Pluto itself is no longer a planet. These are basically gigantic balls of ice comparable to the size of Pluto that are billions and billions of miles from the sun in stable orbits. So we do not think that they pose any danger to the planet Earth because A, they're very far away, B, they're very small, and C, they exist in stable orbits. So we see no indication whatsoever of a large 10th planet, only tiny little ice cubes beyond the orbit of Pluto. And some people think that the existence of a 10th planet could cause a pole shift. Now, it does turn out that the poles of the Earth do shift. For example, go to Hawaii. Drill into the volcanic lava eruptions, and you'll see that the North Pole is actually frozen in a certain direction in the lava. As the lava freezes, so does the direction of the North Pole. And as you drill into the lava flows, you find that the North Pole of the Earth has shifted. However, the shifting of the poles take place over a cycle time of hundreds of thousands of years. Now, it does turn out that the magnetic field of the Earth is weakening. We can see that by simply looking at ancient texts documenting the strength of the magnetic field centuries ago. And sure enough, the magnetic field of the Earth is weakening. However, it'll take thousands of years before the magnetic field of the Earth is weak enough to begin to cause things like, for example, more cosmic rays hitting the planet Earth. This is not going to happen in 2012. It's something that takes place over a cycle time of thousands of years. So a magnetic pole shift is not something to worry about. However, some people talk about a geologic pole shift. That is, what happens if the spin of the Earth and the rotation of the Earth were misaligned? And we see no indication of that happening either. It turns out that the poles of the Earth are quite stable. Even though the magnetic poles have shifted with time, the geologic poles we don't think shift at all, in part because of the Moon. The Moon is quite large in relationship to the Earth, and the very presence of a large moon circulating around the Earth helps to stabilize the Earth and prevent such perturbations around our spin. So we can thank our large moon for preventing us from tipping over. Now, Mars, on the other hand, has no large moon. And so we think, therefore, that Mars in the past probably has tilted and maybe even flipped over. And the same thing with Venus. Venus has no moon to stabilize it. However, we do have a large moon, And as a consequence, the atmosphere of the Earth is relatively stable over a period of billions of years, and that, in turn, helps to make life possible. Well, moving on, there are other predictions, too, with regards to the motion of the Earth with respect to the Milky Way galaxy. First of all, the Milky Way galaxy is about 100,000 light-years across, consists of over 100 billion stars, and we are about two-thirds the way out from the center of the galaxy, and at the very center is a black hole, a raging black hole. This black hole is roughly 3 to 4 million times more massive than our sun, and you can even see the region tonight by looking at the night sky and looking in the direction of Sagittarius. In the direction of Sagittarius is a black hole. In fact, if you could somehow remove the cosmic dust that obscures that black hole to our eyes, then every night you would see a gigantic fireball rise from the night sky. That's right, a fireball that rivals the moon itself in brightness would illuminate the night sky with a black hole at dead center. Unfortunately, because of galactic clouds, we cannot see the fireball. We cannot see this black hole. But there's lots of galactic dust in the galaxy. In fact, that's where we come from. We are made of galactic dust that makes up the disk of the Milky Way galaxy. So first of all, we're not going to get swallowed up by the black hole. Some people think that perhaps December 2012, as the Earth goes around the galaxy, somehow the Earth will fall into the clutches of this black hole. That's not going to happen, because we are outside the event horizon of the black hole, meaning that we are safely in orbit around the black hole. Some people think that perhaps the plane of the galaxy, as the Earth goes through that plane, that will cause doomsday. But you see, right now we are quite above the plane of the Milky Way galaxy, and it'll take millions of years for the Earth to then descend to go through the disk of the Milky Way galaxy. So that's not going to cause doomsday at all either. Other people point to meteors and comets. We've had a number of so-called near misses, objects that are perhaps 1,000 feet across, that come within the orbit of the moon. Well, first of all, it is possible that we could be caught unawares. It's possible that an object perhaps a few miles across could in fact cause tremendous damage. 65 million years ago, we think that an object perhaps no more than 6 miles across destroyed the dinosaurs, paving the way for the rise of you and me and the human race and mammals. However, at the present time, we've been tracking all the debris out there in outer space, and we see no indication whatsoever that an object will destroy the Earth in 2012. In fact, we will have a near miss in 2029 and 2036. The asteroid Apophis, which is about 1,000 feet across, will make a near miss of the Earth in 2029 and again in 2036. And Apophis, if it were to hit the Earth, would wipe out not just London, but it would also wipe out most of England in the process. It is a nation buster, big enough to knock out an entire nation of the planet Earth, but it is simply not clear that anything will come close to the Earth in 2012 that could bring about doomsday. Well, the conspiracy theorists and the people who believe in the 2012 mythology then point to something called solar flares. In fact, last year I did an interview with Fox News concerning the danger, the rather real danger of solar flares. And in fact, that clip that I did has been repeated by these conspiracy theorists who say, aha, the government thereby is covering up the fact that in 2012, a solar flare will cause doomsday. Well, the chances of that happening are extremely small. And like I said, don't sell the house, don't quit your day job, don't get divorced, because chances are you're going to live to see January 2013. First of all, it's not going to cause doomsday because the Earth has gone through many such cycles. This is called the sunspot cycle. the sunspot cycle peaks every 11 years, and sure enough, it's going to peak again in late 2012 and 2013. So some people say, aha, that must be what the Mayan prophecy is talking about. But like I said, the Earth has gone through many a sunspot cycle, and life is still here. However, it does pose a danger for modern society. Back in 1859, we had a gigantic solar flare so intense that it was able to knock out telegraph wires, and it caused an aurora borealis, or northern light, so intense that you could read the newspaper at night in Cuba from the light of the aurora borealis. We've never seen something like that before, so these things do happen. Now, if the Carrington event of 1859 were to happen again, all hell would break loose. First of all, our satellites would be endangered. GPS, the internet, weather satellites, telecommunications could be wiped out. Power stations on the Earth could also be overloaded and blown out. We're talking about blackouts, not just in one, but perhaps hundreds of cities around the Earth, and that could cause severe disruption of civilization. For example, refrigerators get knocked out, meaning that food thaws out and rots, meaning that food riots could take place. We would be thrown back perhaps 150 years into the past by a blackout that is planetary. We've never seen a planetary blackout before. However, we should say two things. First of all, we don't know when another Carrington event would take place. We simply don't know enough about solar flares and what are called coronal mass ejections. And second of all, even if it does happen, it's going to affect our electronics, our satellites, our internet, but not life on the Earth. Life on the Earth has survived quite well over billions of years in spite of solar flares. So in other words, in summary, don't quit your day job. And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have a Nobel laureate, Henry Pollack, a professor at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor, and he's the author of a new book called World Without Ice. He was part of that group that won the Nobel Prize with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. The Nobel Prize in Peace was given to that organization, and he was one of the main authors of that pivotal report on global warming. So what would it be like to live in a world without ice? I guarantee you it's not a world that you want to live in. So once again, our special guest today is Nobel laureate Henry Pollack. Professor Pollack, how did you as a child first get interested in science?
I grew up during World War II. And every day in the newspaper, there were maps of the front in Europe and in Asia and the Pacific. And I just grew very fond of maps and looking at the geography around the globe. And that, in a sense, I think is characteristic of all of my adult research interests, trying to stand back and get a global viewpoint, not just of climate science, but in all the scientific endeavors that I've been involved with in a long career, I've always tried to get a global perspective.
And why geophysics, and specifically, why the weather?
Well, I've not always been interested in the climate. I'm actually not a meteorologist, but my focus on the world's weather really is in the world's climate, which is the long-term average of what the weather gives us. And that's only an interest that has developed in the last two decades. Prior to that, I had done research in seismology, study of earthquakes. I've done work in taking the Earth's temperature, to measure the amount of heat coming out from the interior and its relationship to earthquakes and volcanism. But in the last decade and a half or so, I realized that the rock temperatures that I had been taking for other purposes was also telling us something about what's happening at the Earth's surface. And we were able to reanalyze a lot of that data and reconstruct what the surface temperature of the Earth looked like for about the past 500 years, which conveniently takes us into the pre-industrial era. So there have been many transitions in my scientific interest. All of them, of course, are within the broad realm of Earth science.
Okay, now let's talk about ice. Why is ice so important? Some people say, ha, nothing but polar bears and penguins. Why ice?
Well, ice is important, and the number one reason that it's important is that it plays a big role in the global climate system. Ice is a white substance, and it's very reflective. And the more ice there is on the planet, the less sunshine warms the Earth because it is reflected directly back to space. With less ice, more sunshine falls on the solid Earth and warms us up. So the amount of ice is a very big player in how much sunshine the Earth absorbs.
And
the second reason that ice is important is that it's a very sensitive and unambiguous indicator of climate change because ice on our planet is very close to its melting point. Small changes in the temperature cause very visible changes in the amount and geography of ice on the planet. And so it is what I call nature's best thermometer because it is very, very sensitive to climate change. And then the third reason that ice is important, because as you lose it, important things happen on Earth. The first ice to go will be the mountaintop glaciers in the tropics and the mid-latitudes. And those glaciers today provide agricultural and domestic water to almost a third of Earth's population. That's a very large number of people who rely on that water for their well-being. And the other aspect, of course, of melting ice is that the water eventually runs into the ocean and raises sea level. It's not the only factor that raises sea level. The warming of the ocean water also leads to sea level rises. But sea level rising will, in simple terms, produce climate refugees, and that will be a very serious social problem as we displace people from the coastal region.
And doesn't ice also help to regulate the weather? When we watch the weather in the evening, we see the jet stream coming from the Arctic. So doesn't all that huge mass of cold air also help to regulate the world's weather?
Well, it does indeed. I would in no way minimize the importance of ice in our daily affairs as reflected through the weather. My emphasis has been on the longer-term trends, which we interpret in terms of slow climate change.
Okay, now let's take a look at the data. What evidence do we have that ice is thinning, that glaciers are receding, and what about ice cores that can take us hundreds of thousands of years back into the past?
Well, let's talk first about the evidence for ice receding. We have photographic evidence of mountain glaciers around the globe taken from the times when the camera was first available in the 19th century, more or less, that showed the position of ice in glacial valleys. And throughout the decades, and in fact throughout the 20th century, there are many repeat photographs of glaciers. And so you can just visibly see them receding in their valleys. So it's just visual photographic evidence of that loss of ice. Now, in the Arctic region, the sea ice in the Arctic is simply frozen seawater. We call that sea ice, and it's not very thick. It's on the order of 5 to 10 feet, sometimes a little more than that. But in the summertime, it tends to break up some, and then in the wintertime, it refreezes. But the extent of the summertime breakup has been changing dramatically in the last few decades. We have now only about half the area of sea ice in the summer that we had in the middle of the 20th century. And it's getting thinner as well. The average thickness of sea ice in the Arctic is only half of what it was a half century ago. And so we're faced with the prospect of perhaps an Arctic Ocean that is free of ice in the summertime in just a few decades. So that, too, is a very visible change. There, the observations come from satellites that can look down over the entire Arctic. Now, you asked about the ice cores. Ice cores are a form of sedimentary rock, if you like to think of that, because they have layers that form each year from new snowfall. And as next year's snowfall falls on top of that, it compresses the layers underneath it into ice. And so we have a layer-by-layer, year-by-year history locked up in the ice. But in the case of the Antarctic, the record is almost 800,000 years long. And we are able to tease out of the chemistry of the ice the temperature at which the snow fell at that given year. And another very interesting aspect of those ice cores is that as the snow is compacted and recrystallized into ice, it traps little bubbles of air, which are samples of the atmosphere at the time that the snow fell. And so we are able to chemically analyze the atmosphere year by year, going back almost a million years, to recover the concentrations of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere over long periods of time. What we've learned from that is that the concentration of greenhouse gases today is well beyond the range of natural variability over the past 800,000 years. The ups and downs that Earth's climate has experienced in the last 800,000 years have never gone as high in carbon dioxide as the concentration in the atmosphere is today. So it reveals that we're in the middle of a big inadvertent experiment with the chemistry of the atmosphere and its effects on the global climate that humans have just recognized and are now having to cope with.
And isn't it true that carbon dioxide levels and temperature levels in these ice cores are like two roller coasters in tandem going up and down almost simultaneously over hundreds of thousands of years?
You're absolutely right. That's a wonderful description of it. And what the significance of that is that the temperature of the atmosphere and the carbon dioxide content of the atmosphere are very closely coupled. And when one moves, it will pull the other along with it. And in the present day, what is doing the tugging is that we have increased the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere dramatically, and it is now pulling the temperature along with it. And that's, of course, what we're recognizing as global warming.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for the first part of Exploration. Once again, our special guest today is Nobel laureate Henry Pollack of the University of Michigan. He won the Nobel Prize with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230 for a copy of today's program. Be sure to tune in every Tuesday at 10 o'clock for Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible, a weekly series that I host for the Science Channel. So stay tuned now for the second half of Exploration.
Welcome back to Exploration. Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, Professor of Theoretical Physics at City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York, and this is the second half of Exploration. In the first part of Exploration, we began a discussion with Professor Henry Pollack of the University of Michigan. He's a Nobel laureate, winning the Nobel Prize with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. He won the Nobel Prize for Peace. And in the second half, we're going to continue a discussion of a world without ice. What does it mean if every single glacier on the planet Earth is receding? What does it mean if Greenland starts to break up and melt? What does it mean if we see the beginnings of the hemorrhaging of the South Pole? What does it mean if sea levels begin to rise? What about civilization? What about the coastline of the world? Well, these are some of the questions we're going to ask as we discuss what it means to live in a world without ice with Nobel laureate Henry Pollack. Now, Professor Pollack, where we last left off, we were talking about the poles of the Earth. So let's now discuss the South Pole. We hear reports of gigantic parts of the pole breaking off the size of, let's say, the state of Rhode Island. Could you elaborate?
Sure, I could. There is a lot of ice on Antarctica. It has probably 90% of the global ice. And it is stacked up in places almost 10,000 feet thick and spilling off of the continent and into the sea and building up pools of ice called ice shelves. And these ice shelves are big. You mentioned the size of Rhode Island. Actually, the Ross Ice Shelf on the New Zealand side of Antarctica is as big as France. So these are huge pools of ice. And what we're discovering, what we're observing, is that these ice shelves are becoming unstable and breaking up and dislodging huge amounts of floating ice into the ocean currents around Antarctica. And this ice loss is at a pace that we've not seen before in human history. And so you're looking at instability. The understanding of what's causing it includes both warming, of course, from above, but the seawater is also warming and undermining these ice sheets from below and leading to their breakup. Once they break up, the glaciers that feed them from the interior no longer have a barrier in front of them. And so the glaciers themselves are now speeding up and spilling more ice into the sea. So we see the whole process accelerating as both the air and the ocean water are warming.
And speaking of a spiral effect, the tundra of Siberia is frozen, but as it thaws out, it releases methane gas, which is even worse than carbon dioxide as a global warming gas. Could you elaborate on a positive feedback if tundra begins to melt and release methane, which then heats up the Earth again?
Well, I certainly can. First, there's no question that the tundra is beginning to melt. There's a term called tundra travel days, which indicate how many days of the year you can drive across the frozen tundra because it is frozen. And that number, the tundra travel days, has been diminishing and is now measured in months, not just days, of reduction in tundra travel time. So there's no question that the tundra is softening up and melting. Methane is coming out. There have been measurements made in Siberia and in Alaska of the release of gases from the frozen tundra. And it does contain a great deal of methane, which is indeed another greenhouse gas, more powerful than carbon dioxide. But also it doesn't last as long in the atmosphere. So there is a little bit of a trade-off on that. But the amount of methane that is coming out, as I say, the measurements are just now beginning to be made, and the projections or the models of how this might proceed require that the tundra melt from the top down. And so it's a very slow process of diffusing heat downward into the permafrost. And I guess the good news is that that process, while it will deliver quite a bit of methane, will be spread out over centuries and probably not be a catastrophic release of methane that would lead to an instantaneous enhancement of the greenhouse flagon.
Okay, now let's take a look at the worst-case scenario. Now, remember, this is the worst-case scenario. No one is saying that this is actually going to happen. But the worst-case scenario in 50 years and 100 years, assuming that governments do nothing, that it's business as usual, population grows, economic activity grows. So again, with the caveat that this is a worst-case scenario, 50 years from now, what happens to sea levels? I'm in Manhattan right now. What happens to coastal cities? What happens to the breadbaskets of the world? And then 100 years from now, what are your thoughts?
There are actually three scales, time scales, associated with ice loss. There's the decadal time scale, and in that period of time, the next two or three decades, we're going to see the loss of mountain glaciers everywhere in the world. We're going to see the ice-free Arctic Ocean in the summertime and the issues associated with opening that up to commercial activity. So that's on the decadal time scale, the loss of mountain glaciers and the summertime Arctic Ocean being free of ice and open for commercial activity. On the century-long time scale, we're talking about losing ice in substantial amounts from Greenland and from West Antarctica. Antarctica actually has kind of two geographic regions, the West and the East. The East has the biggest pile of ice, and the West, a smaller pile of ice about the same size as Greenland itself. Now, both Greenland and West Antarctica, each one has the potential of about 20 feet of sea level rise. If we were to lose the ice from Greenland, sea level would rise 20 feet. If we were to lose the ice from Antarctica, West Antarctica, sea level would rise 20 feet. And any partial loss from both could also equal, many feet. So that is on the century-long time scale. And we're already seeing the early hints of that in the acceleration of ice loss from both Greenland and West Antarctica. Now, the big kahuna in all of this is East Antarctica, which has probably the equivalent of something on the order of 200 feet of sea level rise if we were to lose the ice from East Antarctica. But that ice loss, at least at the moment, seems to be on a millennial time scale, over 1,000 years or so. So that aspect of it is probably more delayed in the future. But the 20th century alone could have several feet of sea level rise, and that will be may have very substantial impacts on coastal communities everywhere.
Okay, we had some static there. I guess the static is gone now. Okay, well, we'll edit that static out. Okay.
Okay. Did you want me to comment on New York in particular?
Say a few things about New York and some of the major coastal cities, Boston, New Orleans.
Well, coastal cities everywhere, of course, will be vulnerable to rising sea levels. And you don't need to have 10 feet of sea level rise to have a catastrophe. Just a few feet of sea level rise makes every coastal city more vulnerable to storm surges from what might in the past have been ordinary types of storms and hurricanes. But with higher sea level, everything is more vulnerable. In New York, of course, it's the subway system that is most vulnerable, because once water starts to encroach on Manhattan and the other boroughs, you're going to quickly find you have huge problems with the underground transport system. And there will be aspects of water supply issues that rising sea levels have on coastal communities that draw some of their water from the subsurface. And in areas that have a really flat terrain, such as the major river deltas of the world, particularly those in Asia, the Indus River, the Ganges, the Brahmaputra, the Mekong, the Irrawaddy, all those have very flat terrains that just a few feet of sea level rise will lead to inundation many miles inland, and displacement of a great number of residents and loss of agricultural land.
And what happens to a nation like Bangladesh?
Well, that's a wonderful, I shouldn't say wonderful, but it's a spectacular example of a very flat country that will suffer widespread inundation and displacement of tens of millions of people. And it's, you know, we have some experience with climate refugees in the USA following the Hurricane Katrina flooding of New Orleans. There we have had to address the issues with involving 150,000 people. That will, you know, it's such a tiny fraction of the numbers that will be displaced if we have a few feet of sea level rise in Bangladesh, where it will be in the tens of millions. The difficulties we had addressing climate refugees from Katrina will pale compared to the magnitude of the displacement from sea level rise the world over.
Okay, now let's take a look at some of the critics of this phenomenon, including physicist Freeman Dyson at Princeton. He has two criticisms. He first of all says that rising carbon dioxide level is actually good for plants. Plants will thrive under that situation. And second, more serious, he says that we don't really know how much carbon dioxide is absorbed by the Amazon and by forests and by plants and by algae. And until we have a good handle on the recycling of carbon dioxide through plants, then perhaps these computer models are premature. What are your thoughts?
Well, let me address both of those. The first issue that plants will love it is kind of a facetious response, I think. It is true that carbon dioxide is the food for photosynthesis, and that green plants do take carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and metabolize and give us oxygen as a waste product. But it's not that plants need only carbon dioxide to thrive. They need appropriate amounts of the right kind of nitrogen. They need water availability. And in many, many places and cases, carbon dioxide is not the limiting factor for plant growth. Moreover, it's not only the plants that we might want that will thrive. Well, they'll also see many weeds that will also thrive, and in some cases overtake the vegetation that we might be seeking to enhance. A third aspect of it is that even if some agricultural production might increase, it won't always be in the same place that it was previously because the temperatures are changing as well. And so we're going to see displacements, geographic displacements of agriculture, and that alone will be a social disruption across the agricultural world. So I think that far from being a blessing, some people say that it's a return to the Garden of Eden, but it will hardly be the case. There are many, many more factors than just the availability of carbon dioxide. Now, about his reluctance to do anything until we understand better the uptake of carbon dioxide by the forests of the world, I think that's short-sighted. The one thing that we do know is that the forests of the world are not able to take up as much as we're putting into the atmosphere because the concentration of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has been climbing. As I mentioned earlier, it has climbed out of the range of natural variability of the climate system by a great, great deal. And so whatever the role of the green plants of the earth are, we're overwhelming them with carbon dioxide far beyond what they're able to take up and leading to warming and melting of ice and rising sea levels. So I think we don't have the luxury of waiting to see how the natural world evolves and how it may help in the take-up. I certainly endorse the idea of storing carbon in plants and in algae, and there are experiments underway for large-scale reforestation and for fertilization of the oceans. But none of these experiments that are underway have given us the promise that We have time to spare, and we can wait and see how they work out. We really don't have that much time to spare because the accumulation of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is growing well beyond the ability of the natural world to pull it out.
And what do you say to the critics who say that it's just the sun? The sun is getting hotter. What are your thoughts?
Well, as a good scientist, the usual response is that, well, let's examine that possibility. Let's measure the radiative output from the sun across the full spectrum of wavelengths that the sun is sending energy to Earth. And the measurements of that over the last half century have actually shown that the sun's radiant energy delivery to Earth is slightly diminished. And if it was only the sun that was affecting climate, Earth would have actually been cooling some in the last half of the 20th century and the beginning decade of the 21st. But the measurements show that far from cooling, Earth is actually warming. So the proper way of addressing the causes is to ask, what are the likely factors, both natural and anthropogenic, and try and make measurements of each of them, assess their contribution. And when you do that, you quickly discover that the natural factors have fallen short in terms of accounting for the warming of the last half of the 20th century and that continues today. So the sun, of course, plays a big role in Earth's climate, and it always has. And we want to learn as much about the variability of the solar radiation as possible. But the extensive measurements that we have of that energy from satellites that are orbiting above Earth's atmosphere, so we don't have any atmospheric effects or detractions from it, it's showing that the sun has not been behind the warming that we're observing.
And some of the critics say that, okay, the Earth is heating up. They'll admit that now. But then they say that it's not human activity. It's a natural cycle. So do you have any, like, smoking gun that shows that it's human activity and not a natural thing?
Well, the first thing I would say is that I want to, make people who say that acknowledge that there is a possibility of a human signature first. And I'll give you an analogy that I used in that regard. I always ask, were there ever forest fires before there were people on Earth? And the answer, of course, is yes. We know that lightning can start forest fires, and it did that long before there were people. So then I asked, does that mean that all forest fires today are due to lightning? In other words, is all of today's forest fire activity due to a natural cause? And, of course, the answer to that is no. And the reason is that we have a new player in the forest fire system. We have the humans. We have people, who are malicious arsonists. We have people who fail to put their campfires out. We have people who throw cigarettes out the window while they're driving. And we still have lightning, of course. But what that analogy shows is that even though there are natural factors that cause climate change, now we also have the addition of human factors. Now, how do we know? That just admits the possibility that humans are big players. But how do we know that the human signature is the dominant one today? Well, we've quantified both the radiant energy from the sun. We've quantified the amount of volcanic dust in the atmosphere from eruptions in the 20th century. And calculated their effects on climate. We know how much carbon dioxide has gone into the atmosphere, and we know the absorption that takes place of the infrared radiation trying to leave Earth. And when you look at the numbers, both the sun and the volcanic eruptions, part of the natural forcings, certainly are not leading to warming. The one factor that is the greenhouse gas blanket. And that has been growing in effectiveness, growing in thickness, so to speak, and it's simply trapping more heat that's trying to escape from Earth. Now, there's a lot of more subtle fingerprints, as we call them. One is that if there's increased radiation from the sun, that should warm both the upper atmosphere and the lower atmosphere. But if it's warming that's caused by the greenhouse effect, in other words, radiation trying to leave Earth but being trapped, you find that you warm the lower atmosphere more, but you're trapping the heat, and so the upper atmosphere doesn't get its share, and it cools. And so there's a good test. If the whole atmosphere, upper and lower, is warming, you can point to the sun. If only the lower atmosphere is warming but the upper atmosphere is cooling, that's a fingerprint of greenhouse trapping. And, of course, the measurements of temperature show that the upper atmosphere, the stratosphere, is cooling. And so that's evidence for the greenhouse effect putting its signature on the temperature of the atmosphere.
Okay. Now the question is, what do we do about it? Former President George W. Bush said that, well, maybe we should do our part, but look at China. China puts a coal plant online every week, one coal plant every week, and it's, well, we should spread the burden. So what about a positive program?
Well, I think that the notion that somehow mitigating greenhouse gases is a penalty or a burden on the economy is a false notion. I think that, to the contrary, the factor that will lead to revitalization of the American industrial economy is, in fact, moving away from the fossil fuels into the renewable energy sources, into conservation and efficiencies, and that any nation that takes the lead in developing the new green technologies is going to be the nation that benefits the most, not the nation that is penalized the most. It's quite the contrary. This is an opportunity, not a penalty that we're facing. And so when you look at the nations of the world and ask who is taking the lead in developing wind energy and solar energy, the U.S., of course, is making some steps, but so is Europe and so is China. And China's announced intention is to become the leader in renewable energy. And so I think we're going to see a great competition as to who can step out first and provide the technologies and the concepts that will lead to a revolution in energy production in the 21st century, an entirely new basis of energy that steps away from carbon, which, of course, fueled the Industrial Revolution and right on through the 20th century. But we need to make a change, and the Earth, people on Earth, didn't move out of the Stone Age because we ran out of stone. They moved out because they found better ways to do things. And I think that likewise, we're going to see a revolution in energy, not because we've run out of coal or petroleum, but because we now recognize that there are many better ways of generating energy. And those nations that take the lead are going to be the ones that benefit strongly from it. So I think the USA should see this as an opportunity, not as a penalty.
Well, the car manufacturers are beginning to look at electric cars, plug-in hybrids, and fuel cell cars. However, the critics say that ultimately the electricity for these cars comes from coal plants. And so even if we have electric cars, coal plants will still be spewing enormous amounts of carbon dioxide as you fuel up by plugging your plug-in hybrid into the wall socket. So what about replacing coal?
Well, I think that there is some truth to say that we're going to see electricity generated in part by coal from power plants that are already in existence. But it doesn't mean that coal has to, that the exhaust from that carbon dioxide has to go unlimited into the atmosphere. We can continue to use carbon-based fuels if we can devise ways to capture the greenhouse gases and not let them into the atmosphere and store the greenhouse gases underground or in the deep ocean. If we continue to use the carbon-based fuels, we have to, at the very same time, develop the technologies that will capture the carbon dioxide and not let it into the atmosphere. So we can have a lot of electricity. And, of course, eventually we're going to see electricity, solar voltaic electricity. We're going to see geothermal electricity. I think we're going to see lots of renewable sources of electricity that will replace the carbon-based fuels that we're using now.
One last question. Some people say that the cost of solar hydrogen is going down, but that there's no one single replacement for oil. We have wind power, we have windmills, we have photovoltaics, but there's no one source of power that's going to be like a white knight that saves us, and in fact, it's probably going to be a very complex mix for many a decade. What are your thoughts?
I think that's right. And I don't think that is something that's ominous and that we should be worried about. It will require that we rethink the nature of our electrical distribution system to allow for multiple and widely distributed generation sources rather than the few concentrated ones which we currently have at the big mega plants that use a lot of coal. It is true that there is no silver bullet that is going to let us easily march into the future with a single new technological breakthrough. We have a lot of technologies that are in their evolutionary stage, some at greater levels of maturity than others. And we right now, to make the transition away from the carbon-based fuels, we need every horse in the stable pulling. We don't have the luxury to say, well, I think wind is better than solar photovoltaics, or I think that the ocean currents are better than geothermal. Everything has certain problems with it now in the developmental stage, but we need them all to be moving ahead simultaneously. As I said, you know, we need every horse in the stable pulling, and it will lead to a future energy environment that is highly complex, with multiple sources that each have their own advantages and disadvantages, but all contribute to the replacement of the carbon-based fuels.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest today was Professor Henry Pollack, Nobel laureate. He won the Nobel Prize for Peace with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And we're talking about his latest book, a very unnerving book, a disturbing book, a book about our future. The book is called World Without Ice. And if you want a copy of today's program, call the Pacifica Program Service at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you get the Science Channel, tune in every week, Tuesdays at 10 o'clock. I host a new series for the Science Channel called Sci-Fi Science, Physics of the Impossible, based on my New York Times bestseller, Physics of the Impossible. So once again, good day for exploration.